tin can, I pretend to hold you to my breast and fire. Yet you're waiting from the back roads by the rivers of my memories, never smiling, never dreaming on my mind. Yet you're waiting from the back roads by the rivers of my memories, never smiling, never dreaming.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the David Pakman Show. I'm producer Pat Ford, filling in for David today as he continues his paternity leave. David should be making his triumphant return to the show soon, relatively soon, but he's, of course, taking this time to enjoy himself as a new parent and to spend some time with the little one and get some sleep whenever he can find the time to. Today we're going to be talking about a number of different topics. We're going to be talking about the January 6th hearings. We're going to talk about inflation and gas prices and all of these different things. But I wanted to start today talking about gun control because there's a new bipartisan deal in the Senate on the topic of gun control, and it actually includes 10 Republican senators, which is crucial because that means there's a solid chance of this actually passing in the coming weeks and becoming law. I don't want to celebrate it too much because, for one, it hasn't actually happened yet, right? And these things could fall through. We need to see the actual text. But also, it seems a little bit lackluster. It doesn't come nearly close to all the things that we have to do to actually make a difference when it comes to guns and gun safety in this country. But given the fact that Republicans have been steadfast in their refusal to do anything about guns in the wake of mass shootings over the years, it's hard to not feel some level of optimism over this announced agreement. The deal will include support for state crisis intervention orders, funding for school safety resources, an enhanced review process for buyers of guns under the age of 21, and penalties for straw purchases. That's when you have one person purchase a weapon on someone else's behalf. The legislation will also have a red flag provision so that states and courts will have the resources to make sure firearms are kept out of the hands of people who are at significant risk of doing harm with them. There's also going to be increased funding for mental health, suicide prevention, and trauma intervention, which is, of course, an important aspect to all of this. We know that the right wing in this country loves to claim that mass shootings are all about mental health and that they're just exclusively a mental health issue. We know that they just use it as a red herring, but there's something to that, right? Because that is one aspect in all of this, and we have to not only look at gun control measures, we have to look at the mental health side as well. So if they're willing to have a good faith conversation about mental health, we should absolutely take them up on that and take advantage of it. The 10 Republican senators who have signed on to this piece of legislation that's in the works are John Cornyn, Tom Tillis, Richard Burr, Roy Blunt, Bill Cassidy, Susan Collins, Lindsey Graham, Rob Portman, Mitt Romney, and Pat Toomey. The centrist Democrats who tend to torpedo pieces of legislation that we like as progressives and Democrats, those are Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, they've also pledged their support. So this is very, very promising. Joe Biden said about this, quote, "Obviously, it does not do everything that I think is needed, but it reflects important steps in the right direction and would make the most significant gun safety legislation to pass Congress in decades." Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said about the bill, "If we get a real baby step, not kind of a distraction from the solution, she's going to support it." So both Biden and AOC kind of providing the same sentiment there that, like, yeah, this is great and all, but we could just do so much more if we had more willingness from the Republicans to do anything about guns. Sadly, I think this is going to be treated as the solution. That's probably what we'll see. We'll probably see this get signed into law, and then they'll do some sort of victory lap, and everyone will pretend as if we actually did something significant when it comes to gun safety in this country, when we know we can just go so much further. You know, there are some solid provisions in this legislation, that's for sure, but we know that we can do more when it comes to universal background checks, raising the legal age to own a semi-automatic rifle to 21, magazine capacity limits. None of that stuff's in there. So maybe we can try with future legislation, but it just doesn't seem like it's going to be able to happen anytime soon for as long as we have such a slim majority in Congress and for as long as Republicans are not willing to compromise on much when it comes to this issue. So definitely go ahead, pass the bill. Let's try to avoid the victory laps afterwards. I want to see us try to make this a voting issue come the 2022 midterms, because it seems like now we do have somewhat of a chance of maybe holding on to the House and Senate. It would be great, too, to pick up an extra 2 Senate seats because that means that we could potentially eliminate the filibuster and do so much more. And I think, you know, this focus on abortion and gun control at this point, given how the economy is, might have to be the path forward for Democrats. The kitchen table issues tend to be more economic and financial issues. And there's some aspects of that that, you know, we're having a tough time communicating about because gas prices are so high, inflation so high. So maybe given the Supreme Court's leaked draft opinion when it comes to abortion, maybe, you know, the mass shootings and the backing for new gun control measures, that's going to be enough to maybe propel Democrats to hold on to the majorities. But we just don't know yet. And we really don't know what the big issues are going to be once it's actually time to vote. So that's the latest when it comes to gun control. It looks like we're going to have some piece of legislation pass through the Senate and the House, and that's very good to see. Last Friday, we got the new consumer price index data, and we found out that the inflation rate year over year for the month of May was 8.6%. There was this idea before the numbers were released that maybe inflation had peaked over the past couple months and we'd start to head down a little bit. But this new data release really throws a wrench into that theory because we're still trending upwards, albeit slightly. In March, we were at 8.5% year-over-year inflation. In April, we declined modestly to 8.3%. And in May, once again, we went up to 8.6%. It was predicted by economists ahead of the CPI data release that inflation would go down to about 8.2%. So instead of being slightly down, we're heading slightly up. The Consumer Price Index, or CPI, is a broad assessment of prices in the economy, including everything from food to fuel to housing to discretionary products. The main reason for the CPI increase appears to be that gas prices have gone up quite significantly over the past month or so. Gas prices due to pent-up demand in the economy, given the recovery from the pandemic and due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and other factors, continue to go up. They just reached a record $5 a gallon, and it's likely a trend that's going to continue all summer long because we know that gas prices tend to go up with demand during the summer months, and certainly the situation in Russia and Ukraine has not settled down, so we may see $6 gallon gasoline relatively soon. Who knows? So it's going to be difficult, of course, to have CPI data going down when you have gas prices going up so significantly. If you're going to do that, you really have to make up for it in the other categories that it assesses, and we just did not do nearly enough to make up for it. Interestingly enough, though, core inflation, which removes food and energy from the index, is at 6% for the month of May. Year over year, whereas in April it was at 6.2%. So that's positive. That's heading in the right direction. But some people will say, well, you can't just really take out energy and food costs from the equation, given that they're such an important metric of what takes place in the economy. The CPI release caused the markets to tumble quite a bit at the end of last week. On Thursday and Friday, we saw the major indices drop about 3-4%. And the reason is that high inflation means that the Federal Reserve is probably going to have to be more hawkish when it comes to raising interest rates, how often they're going to raise the interest rates, and by how much. Because the idea is if you have high inflation, you have to cool down the economy to encourage less spending. And that means that companies won't be able to make as much profit, which means that investors won't make as much money, which means that people often will sell off. Aside from raising the interest rates, which is really under the purview of the Federal Reserve, there's not much that the Biden administration can do when it comes to inflation and gas prices. That's just the sad reality in all of this. When it comes to gas prices, we know that he can take more out from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, but that maybe will save you 10 cents here, 20 cents here. It's not going to be enough to significantly drive costs down. And we also know that the Strategic Petroleum Reserve really is meant for emergencies. So if there was a serious emergency that came our way and we had just released a bunch of oil and gas, that may not be the best thing to do. Just about every country we know is dealing with the high gas prices and the high inflation. So for me personally, I have a tough time blaming Joe Biden for this. The people who think that Trump and Republicans would do better, I'd like to hear how they would go about doing that. I think there's just a sentiment of, well, when Donald Trump and the Republicans were in charge, we didn't have high inflation, we didn't have gas prices, so clearly if we put them back in charge, they'd be able to get a handle on it. But that's really just not how it works. Unfortunately, the average voter doesn't know about that. They don't know that presidents have very little control over inflation and gas prices. So it's going to be tough to communicate that to the American people ahead of the midterms, especially when these really are kitchen table issues. Can we afford gas? Can we afford these other things because prices everywhere are going up? So it's a big challenge for Democrats heading into the midterms. We definitely want to focus on gun control and abortion because we're thinking more and more those could be winning issues for us in November. But we also have to effectively address address how we're going to try to get a handle on inflation and gas prices, even if it's just doing whatever we can, right, to make some sort of effort to appeal to people to vote for us again. So that's the latest when it comes to inflation, gas prices. Doesn't seem like we have it under control yet. Donald Trump has turned on his own daughter. And no, I'm not talking about Tiffany, who Trump doesn't seem to have the best relationship with. I'm talking about Ivanka, who Trump once said that if she wasn't my daughter, perhaps I would be dating her. The context of this betrayal goes back to the January 6th hearings, which began on Thursday. We're going to have day two of those hearings tonight, and they'll continue throughout the week. But last Thursday, on the first day, there was video testimony from Ivanka that was played, and it showed her basically saying that she did not agree with the bogus election fraud conspiracy theories as they were being made by Trump and his allies, and she instead trusted the word of Attorney General Bill Barr in his assessment that what Trump and folks who were supporting him were coming up with when it came to the voter fraud stuff was just a bunch of hogwash. Now, we've known ever since the beginning of the big lie that Ivanka and her husband, Jared Kushner, were not on board with the big lie. They didn't want anything to do with it. They wanted Trump to concede to Biden when it was clear that he had lost. And, you know, Ivanka and Jared, they're not really the most ethical people, but at the very least, they were not willing to go along with parroting the lies of Trump and the people around him at the time who were trying to end democracy effectively in the United States. But now we're going a step further because it's not just that Ivanka Trump is trying to hide from the spotlight when it comes to this voter fraud issue and the 2020 election stuff in general. She's actually had to make a stand when it comes to this, and she has with this video testimony saying that, yeah, she thought that what Trump and his allies were saying at the time was bogus. Let's first play the clip of what Ivanka said at that testimony, and then we'll go to Trump's reaction.
Told the president in no uncertain terms that I did not see evidence of fraud and that would have affected the outcome of the election. And frankly, a year and a half later, I haven't seen anything to change my mind on that.
How did that affect your perspective about the election when Attorney General Barr made that statement?
It affected my perspective. I respect Attorney General Barr. So I accepted what he was saying.
Okay, so nothing over the top there, just a simple, yeah, I agreed with Bill Barr's assessment about the election and didn't buy into the bogus voter fraud claims. But Donald Trump will not allow even a modicum of criticism to come his way from family members or from anyone else, and so he just couldn't help himself but to take to Truth Social, or Troth Central, as he likes to call it, and he had to post one of his truths, as they're called, quite Orwellianly so, by the way. He posted, quote, Ivanka Trump was not involved in looking at or studying election results. She had long since checked out and was, in my opinion, only trying to be respectful to Bill Barr and his position as attorney general. He sucked. So Trump is implying two things there. One, that she didn't really mean what she was saying. She was just trying to be a kind-hearted person and was trying to stay on Bill Barr's good side. But also, it's evident from this that her opinion really isn't all that valid, right, according to Trump, because he says that she's not well-informed when it comes to the 2020 election. She checked out. She wasn't one of the primary people studying the issue. And that's interesting because Trump and his allies have been going around for the past year plus talking about how the fraud was so obvious that we can all see it, right? You don't have to study it too extensively. You can just know by looking at, you know, the voting machines and the dead people voting and the ballot harvesting and all of this nonsense stuff that clearly there was election fraud in the 2020 race. Well, if it's so clear that the general public can see it, how come Ivanka Trump, who had a role in the White House and presumably wanted to keep that role for the next 4 years during a second Trump term, how come she couldn't see it? Well, you know, she just wasn't looking into it strongly enough, I guess. So obviously, Ivanka is on the right end of this, but it's just fun to watch because we know that Thanksgiving dinner this year is going to be awkward at the Trump family residence. And, you know, I think anyone else in Trump's position after getting contradicted by your family member would just do your best to ignore it, right, to keep shut. But Trump just can't help himself. He had to take to social media to complain about this. And, you know, I think this is probably enough It's just, you know, barely enough, but I think it is enough to add Ivanka Trump to the list of people who Donald Trump has turned on over the years. Who knew? His own daughter. She has made the naughty list. I talked about this next story on last Friday's bonus show, but it's just such an important media story I thought it'd be good to cover again today for the general David Pakman Show audience. And that is that as I was watching day one of the January 6th hearings last Thursday, I couldn't help but wonder, is Fox News broadcasting this? Because on the one hand, it's a highly relevant thing that's going on in the world of politics, so you'd think that a news and politics TV station would have to cover it. On the other hand, the January 6th hearings are really making Trump look bad, really making his allies look bad, and even making Fox News personalities look bad because, you know, we found out about how Sean Hannity was texting Kayleigh McEnany as the Capitol riots were unfolding, trying to get her to get the president to get his supporters out of the Capitol on that day. Well, what I saw was Tucker Carlson's show, and they had a live feed up of the hearing, but they weren't playing audio from it. They were just showing the visuals. And Tucker went on the show and he brought on guests and he was complaining about how the whole ordeal was overblown and how we're not talking about the real issues because we're so wrapped up in January 6th still. Carlson called the hearing deranged. He called it insulting and he took a moral stand. He said that he was going to simply refuse to play along. The lower third graphics during the show, that's the chyrons at the bottom, they were saying things like January 6th committee fuels false narratives as sham investigation draws on. There was another one that said leaders will spend 90 minutes giving moral lecture. A third one said our leaders are focusing on January 6th while ignoring the real threats. Here's a clip from Tucker Carlson's opening monologue.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson. You know, it tells you a lot about the priorities of our ruling class that the rest of us are getting yet another lecture about January 6th tonight from our moral inferiors, no less. An outbreak of mob violence, a forgettably minor outbreak by recent standards that took place more than a year and a half ago, but they've never stopped talking about it. In the meantime, in the 18 months since January 6th, gas prices have doubled. Drug ODs have reached their highest point ever. The U.S. economy is now careening toward a devastating recession at best. And scariest and least noted of all, this country has never in its history been closer to a nuclear war. Yet the other networks cannot be bothered to cover any of that tonight. Instead, they've interrupted their regularly scheduled programming to bring you yet another extended primetime harangue from Nancy Pelosi and Liz Cheney about Donald Trump and QAnon. The whole thing is insulting. In fact, it's deranged, and we're not playing along. This is the only hour on an American news channel that will not be carrying their propaganda live. They are lying, and we are not going to help them do it. What we will do instead is to try to tell you the truth. We've attempted to do that since the day this happened. We hated seeing vandalism at the U.S. Capitol a year and a half ago, and we said so at the time. But we did not think it was an insurrection because it was not an insurrection. It was not even close to an insurrection.
Now, what's also interesting in all of this is that during the entire broadcast, they didn't actually cut to a commercial break. And you have to wonder why that is, right? Because it's a TV show like any other show. You're going to go to commercials every 15 minutes to give time for the sponsors. Well, what appears to have happened is that Fox executives didn't want people to have the opportunity to change the channel, right? Because if they go to break at Fox, maybe people will tune over to CNN or another news station, and then maybe they'll come across the hearings with the audio, and then they may actually learn a thing or two about January 6th. So couldn't have that, which meant that you couldn't have commercials. And that's really telling, right? Because on the one hand, Fox is saying that January 6th, it was a nothing burger. There's too much focus on it. It was just a tourist visit. Nothing to see here. And on the other hand, they're unwilling to go to commercial breaks. They're unwilling to broadcast the hearing with audio. So they definitely have something to hide when it comes to all of this. And they want to make sure that their viewers don't learn too much more about the events of January 6th and the lead up. Now, I'm sure we'll be talking more about the hearings as they continue this week. But to be honest, from day one of the hearings, I had mixed feelings because I thought that the video testimonies, those were effective. I thought that the footage of the riots and, you know, the Trump supporters who were fighting with the cops and all that stuff, I thought it was very effective. What I didn't think was so effective was some of the long-winded speeches and the testimony from the police officer and the documentarian and the focus on the Proud Boys and all that stuff. I think if it was a little bit more condensed, it would be more effective, but that's just my view anyway. You're trying to appeal to people who haven't made up their minds when it comes to January 6th, and I think less is more when it comes to this stuff. So we'll see what happens over the next few days as the hearings continue, if they are able to engage with the audience any better, and if the public is able to come away from this all thinking that there really needs to be consequences for the people who were involved on January 6th, because it was a terrible thing that happened in our country and it should never happen again. This next story is just an incredible display of hypocrisy from Donald Trump and the so-called pro-free speech right wing. Truth Social, the Twitter copy that Trump made after he got kicked off to Twitter about a year and a half ago, is reportedly banning users for being critical of what happened to the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th, 2021. There are a number of reports of users claiming that their accounts were suspended for talking about what exactly happened on the 6th and talking about the hearings and talking about things that just simply make Donald Trump look bad. Let's take a look at some of the screenshots of people going to Twitter to complain about how they were censored on Truth Social. A user named Jack said, "I was suspended from Truth Social for posting about the January 6th hearing last night. Donald Trump is scared of free speech." Joseph wrote, "Just put out my first post on Truth Social and they deleted it. Real freedom of speech champs there." And then a user named Travis said, quote, "My Truth Social account was just permanently suspended for talking about the January 6th committee hearings, including a screenshot of his account being suspended." And I feel like you already know what the analysis is going to be here. This is just the most hypocritical thing possible, because like the whole point of Truth Social was supposed to be that it was going to allow for free speech and the free exchange of ideas, and they were not going to censor people and ban people needlessly and all these different things. But then you take a look at how it's been in practice, and it's basically just been like the right-wing Trumpian version of Twitter, which is fine if they want to do that, but it was marketed originally as a free speech version of the popular social media site, so they're not really doing the things that they set out to do. And the second that they see something that they don't like, that they disagree with, stuff talking about the insurrection, things talking about Trump looking bad, they decide to take down the posts, they suspend the accounts. And there's actually an argument to be made that they're actually being more censorious than Twitter is with some of these moves that they've made. So what exactly is the point of Truth Social? I don't know at this point. They're changing it day to day, it seems. Maybe it's just really to make a site where Trump is able to speak his mind, and he needed to do something that involved other users because the blog posts that he had, the official messages from the office of the former president, that just wasn't cutting it anymore. And the bottom line is they don't care about the hypocrisy, right? Republicans in recent years, they just don't even respond to the points about hypocrisy burning when we point out that they're doing one thing and saying another. And what also isn't new is the fact that Truth Social has these policies, because even before they launched, it was clear that they were going to censor certain posts when it comes to disinformation, when it comes to sensitive content. And then they also said something at the very beginning, which was that they were going to prohibit posts that disparage, tarnish, or otherwise harm, in our opinion, us and or the site. So on Truth Social, you can get censored or banned for daring to criticize Donald Trump or Devin Nunes or the website at large. And again, this goes to the point about this is actually more censorious than Twitter is, because it's not like Twitter has an analogous policy to this. You can go on Twitter and criticize Twitter. You can go on Twitter and criticize the executives there. Clearly, there's a line you can't cross with the criticism, right? You can't be like threatening anyone, but you're able to do generic criticism just fine on Twitter. And while we're on the topic of Republican hypocrisy on this issue, I wonder if now that Republicans want Twitter and these other social media platforms to be regulated like public utilities, if they would say the same thing about Truth Social, if they want Truth Social to be nationalized or socialized. I'm not holding my breath. I would imagine that they want it for Twitter, but not for Truth Social. So that's just the latest on Truth Social. I do think that we're going to be talking more and more about it as the months go on, because it appeared at first that this was going to die out because they had a really bad launch from a tech perspective and things weren't working right. And also there was the news about Elon Musk planning to buy Twitter. So there was this idea that he was going to allow Trump back on Twitter. And at that point, why even have a social media site of your own? Why not just go back to Twitter? But for now, Truth Social is here to stay, and we'll have to continue covering the blatant hypocrisy. Republican Florida Representative Matt Gaetz is probably not the wackiest member of Congress or the dumbest member of Congress. I think we have to give those titles to people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and Louis Gohmert, but Gaetz, he has to be the most despicable member of Congress, right? And there's definitely some supporting evidence for this, like starting with the fact that he's under investigation for alleged sex trafficking and prostitution of minors. You really don't have to go further than that. Although, to be fair, he's only been accused at this point, but the investigation is well underway, and certainly the evidence against him continues to mount. But as if we needed another example, here is Matt Gaetz chatting it up with Marjorie Taylor Greene on Greene's podcast, and he makes the case that Jamie Raskin, who is serving on the January 6th committee, shouldn't be allowed to serve on the committee because his son died by suicide not that long ago, and the trauma from that must be clouding his judgment. That's how Matt Gaetz put it. Let's take a look at the video clip.
What I worry about with Raskin, in all seriousness, you know, when people encounter trauma, they often associate a lot of the other things around that trauma with it, even if they don't naturally or even rationally associate.
Maybe so.
And what I worry about for the Congress and for Jamie Raskin, you know, no one would ever want to lose a child, particularly to suicide.
Of course
not. As a human being, our hearts go out to him. But I think that he takes that trauma and he associates it now with his work in the Congress to such an interwoven way that he's unable to kind of do the congressional experience outside of the dungeon of that personal trauma. And I think it makes him look at everything in these very like dark and severe ways where, you know, we try to come to the job really to uplift people.
We're here to serve the people.
Well, and we love this country. Absolutely. We're not here out of a sense of grievance or hatred. We love America.
We love it.
And we want to vindicate the rights of our citizens, and we want to champion their causes battle their dislikes. But I think for Jamie Raskin, it's really like his service in the Congress has almost become like inextricably attached to this sad personal trauma he's had. And I think it does cloud his judgment. And we could see that very darkness and that pain manifest on Thursday.
Now, there's definitely multiple layers to this story, but I think the main one is that Matt Gaetz really just has to shut his mouth and not invoke the name of Raskin's deceased son to make a cheap political point. Like, we know what he's trying to do with this. He makes this disclaimer about how we're not, you know, wishing death on anyone or trauma on anyone, Democrat or Republican. But come on, like, we know the point that you're trying to make here. The other layer to all this is that logically it doesn't really seem to add up either, because plenty of people experience trauma at some point during their lifetimes. Does that mean that they have to quit their jobs or, you know, not participate in certain aspects of their jobs? Of course not. That doesn't make any sense. And if so, like, how much trauma is so much where you're not able to perform your job responsibilities? The whole thing just doesn't really seem to add up. I don't know why he decided to make this point to begin with. But this also goes to show that Matt Gaetz is probably worried about the hearings and the things that Raskin and the other committee members are going to uncover, because we know that Raskin certainly is a force to be reckoned with, and Matt Gaetz probably can tell that the things that the committee is going to uncover in the next few weeks is not going to be good for the Trumpian right wing. AOC also responded to this statement from Matt Gaetz with a tweet. She said, quote, "Rep. Raskin is a greater statesman, congressman, human being than most of us. History will remember him. Tommy was a remarkable person and testament of his parents' love. Gaetz is a bad haircut in a cheap suit, a feat of mediocrity given that he's here on Papa's money. Bye." So an excellent point there from AOC. You gotta wonder if Gaetz regrets this comment that he made, because he really just doesn't look good. He looks dumb, and he also looks like he's insensitive when it comes to this stuff. So gotta wonder, does he regret it? I also kind of get the sense that he's the kind of person who would just double down and really not care that he did wrong and not admit to doing wrong with this. Also during this appearance, Matt Gaetz brought up the idea of giving Nancy Pelosi a sponge bath. In what was an incredibly weird moment, Luke Beasley, who hosted on Friday, he talked about this, but I just had to use this opportunity to play that clip again. Let's roll it one more time.
It will.
Is he your least favorite member?
I have
he's
a lot
mine.
Of...
He's mine. I'm on record.
He's at the top for me.
I would rather give Nancy Pelosi a sponge bath than endure like one dinner
that's
with
disgusting.
Adam Schiff. Totally. That's... But just yeah. to bring this
no,
into technicolor for you. Okay. Like a lot of people would say maybe Pelosi is their least favorite member. No way.
But
Schiff
would you
is
trim
like
her
utterly
toenails?
The most.
Would you trim her toenails?
I would trim her toenails with my teeth wow. before I would go to
Man,
dinner with
impressive.
Adam Kinzinger.
That's really impressive.
Or Adam right. Schiff, I should say.
So here's how I feel about Adam.
Big yikes there. That was an uncomfortable conversation and probably another example of something that would have been better left unsaid during this Marjorie Taylor Greene podcast appearance. And I'm wondering if Matt Gaetz is going to be able to win his primary in August or if he can win the general election come November, because certainly the first district of Florida is very, very conservative, but there's some real accusations against him when it comes to this child prostitution and sex trafficking stuff that I think even many members of the right wing are not going to tolerate. Like if they're given the option in Florida in this first district of voting for Matt Gaetz, who is a Trumpian Republican and a cartoon character, but also has these allegations against him, versus just another Trumpian Republican cartoon character, they'd probably go with the second one, right? Because there's a lot less baggage when it comes to that hypothetical other option that they have. So I'm hoping that this is the last 7 months that Matt Gaetz is a congressman, and I hope it comes to an end for him, either because he's facing some serious criminal charges or because he loses his re-election bid. We should be finding out relatively soon whether Donald Trump is going to be indicted for his role in allegedly trying to overturn the presidential election results in Georgia back in 2020. And the person who is saying that the decision is coming soon is someone who would know a thing or two about it. It's Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis, who is the Georgia prosecutor investigating whether Trump broke election laws in the state by trying to strong-arm Brad Raffensperger and get him to find the, quote, 11,780 votes. She told the Associated Press that she expects to come to a decision about whether to indict Trump by June 30th. Now, that sounds very direct, and it definitely sounds like it's coming soon, especially because we're in the middle of June now. But then you find out there's a catch, and that catch is that she actually made the statement back in January. She said, quote, "I certainly think that in the first half of the year, that decision will be made. But who knows if between now and then things have changed, if the timeline has been moved back." What is promising, though, is that Willis has been ramping up her investigation in recent months. She's interviewed a few dozen people, including Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. She was granted approval for a special grand jury, but has held off on having witnesses testify before the jury. Willis has also commented that she would want to make the announcement after the primary elections as to not give the appearance of a conflict of interest or trying to influence the race in any way. And those primary elections took place a few weeks ago in Georgia. So now seems like the right time to come out with the announcement, right? Are you going to indict him or are you not? Especially because if she's worried about this idea of election interference, then, you know, you don't want to wait so long as to run up against the November midterms. You don't want to wait until right before the general election either. So I'd imagine it's probably coming soon. To me, for what it's worth, I think that Trump clearly broke the law on this. I think it's a slam dunk case. If you look at the Georgia election law, it says, quote, "A person commits the offense of criminal solicitation to commit election fraud in the first degree when, with intent that another person engage in conduct constituting a felony under this article, he or she solicits, requests, commands, importunes, or otherwise attempts to cause the other person to engage in such conduct, and the punishment is somewhere between 1 and 3 years in prison." For what it's worth, and I'm no lawyer, but if you take a look at the letter of the law there, it certainly looks like Donald Trump committed this crime, and you at least have enough evidence to go to an indictment, and we'll let the jury decide whether he is guilty. They also have audio recordings of him. They can establish that there was a well-planned, well-coordinated effort to do this. It certainly wasn't a one-off thing by Trump, too. Like, he definitely has a pattern of this, and there's witnesses. Like, you definitely have a solid case here. So my sense is that if they decide not to indict, it's going to be more of a political calculation than a criminal one. They may just say, you know, we've never prosecuted a former president. We don't want to go down that road, so we're going to let him off the hook here. And I hope that doesn't happen. I hope that he's held accountable. Also, someone who thinks that Trump is going to be indicted in this Georgia case is Eric Holder, who was Obama's attorney general. Let's take a look at him saying that he suspects an indictment is going to come soon.
I think, you know, you can look at what Merrick Garland is going to do. I think my primary, my first analysis would be what's going to happen to him in Georgia. Well, you've got him on tape saying, you know, find me 11,780 votes. That one is close to a layup, it seems to me.
Right. I've always said the same thing about that one. Why don't they just go after that one moment? It's on tape. You have the smoking gun. He's saying, I remember when Rod Blagojevich was on tape. Basically,
that didn't work out too well for him.
No, I know, but it was pretty blatant, but it wasn't as bad as find me 11,000 votes.
Yeah. No, I think, as I said, I think that's close to a layup. The DA down there is going to be calling witnesses, I understand, before a special grand jury. But the interesting thing there is that that can also be a specification and a federal charge that could be brought in Washington, D.C. when you're charging him with conspiracy to defraud and conspiracy to obstruct. What happened in Georgia can actually be part of a federal case as well. So I think, you know, I was a federal prosecutor doing political corruption cases when I first came to the Justice Department for 12 years, and you get a feel for these things after a while. I get the feeling that I can see where this one is going, and a lot of high-level people in the Trump administration, I suspect the president himself, people at the Justice Department are all going to find themselves on a little document that says the United States versus fill in the blank.
So there you have it, Eric Holder suspecting that Donald Trump is going to be indicted in this Georgia election fraud case. And I just get the sense that if Trump is going to have to face any consequences for his alleged wrongdoings, it's going to be because of this Georgia case. Like the other investigations, I just don't see them going anywhere at this point. The one out of New York, for example, there just doesn't seem to be the appetite to charge him. And we've had resignations because it seems clear that they're just not willing to go in that direction. Merrick Garland and the Biden Justice Department, I just don't know if they want to open up a can of worms and start this tradition of presidents prosecuting former presidents. Trump probably could get charged for his alleged financial crimes and his role in the insurrection and the hush money payments that he had Michael Cohen allegedly issue and that Cohen went to jail for. But to me, this one just seems like it has the highest chance of actually getting an indictment, going to trial, and getting a conviction. So we'll see how it goes. We're going to find out whether Trump will actually ever have to face consequences for anything in his life. Kyle Rittenhouse is doing his rounds in conservative circles, and the latest on him is that there's actually a dispute between him and Texas A&M University over whether he's going to be going to school there in the fall and taking classes. Kyle said recently on the Charlie Kirk show that he was going to be going to the university. The university, however, says otherwise. They say that he has not been admitted and won't be taking classes there. How on earth did this happen? Let's first go to the clip of Kyle explaining to Charlie Kirk that he is going to become an Aggie and putting on the Texas A&M cap to celebrate.
He's ready to make this is like he's ready to make it. Wow, everybody, it's a big deal. Right here on the Charlie Kirk show, Kyle Rittenhouse is announcing that he's an Aggie.
So, I'm going to be going there. It's going to be awesome. Beautiful campus, amazing people, amazing food. We went to Dixie's Chicken there. Best burgers I've ever
had.
That's
why he's going.
Dixie's Chicken, everybody.
Now, you know what they say at A&M? They say gig'em.
Gig'em.
And you know how they say hello? They say howdy.
Howdy.
So there you go. And so are you gonna join the Corps of Cadets?
I haven't decided yet. I may.
Well, that was all very interesting, but the university disputes Kyle's claim on this. Kelly Brown, who's the spokesperson for Texas A&M, said, quote, "He has not been admitted as a student this summer or fall." Now, typically, when you have one person claiming one thing and another person claiming another, you have to sort of weigh the arguments to determine who's in the right and who's in the wrong, or maybe who's telling the truth and who's not telling the truth. With a case like this, though, it's pretty clear that whatever Texas A&M says goes, like they're going to be the correct ones in all of this because it's up to them, right? If they don't want to allow him as a student at the school, then he's not going to be going to that school. And that's just kind of the end of that. Like, I could say that I'm going to Harvard or Yale or wherever to take classes, but if those schools don't actually admit me, then I'm not going to be going to those universities. But with regard to this Texas A&M situation, I just wonder exactly how it happened, right? Like, Was he sent a denial letter, but he thought it was an acceptance letter? Was he initially accepted and then they decided to rescind the acceptance? Was there just some incredible misunderstanding? What exactly happened? I mean, maybe there was a planned charade with all this where he wanted to force the university's hand into allowing him to go to the school. And maybe he wanted to make some broader point to a right-wing audience about liberal indoctrination and cancel culture at college campuses. I'm just not exactly sure. Funny enough, Kyle has been working on a grift he calls the Media Accountability Project, or TMAP. I don't know why they didn't just go with MAP for the acronym. They went with TMAP. But TMAP has the purpose of suing people for defamation and going after the corporate press because Kyle felt like he was defamed during his murder trial. And so he wants to get revenge against a bunch of people. But it's like one of those things where, Kyle, if you're going to be doing this, if you're going to be working for TMAP, you can't be going on Charlie Kirk's show and saying things that aren't true because maybe the organization is going to have to go after you. Before this, Kyle was taking classes at ASU, Arizona State University, and he dropped the classes to focus on the homicide trial. He wanted to resume classes there after the trial ended, but a bunch of students had an uproar and the university decided to cut ties with him. He said in a follow-up tweet that actually he's going to be going to Blinn College, a community school out in Texas, tweeting, "Unfortunately, the end of my high school career was robbed from me. I didn't have the time other students get to properly prepare for the future. I look forward to attending Blinn College District this year, a feeder school for Texas A&M. I'm excited to join Texas A&M in 2023. So apparently he's going to Blinn College, although how can we know for sure? Because he wasn't exactly accurate when it came to the Texas A&M situation. So maybe in a week or two, we'll find out that he actually wasn't admitted there. And wouldn't that be something? And you have to wonder also if this is going to cause a wave of students to leave Blinn College to transfer somewhere else because they just don't want to associate with Kyle Rittenhouse. And I feel mixed feelings about that sort of thing because on the one hand, those students have every right to transfer if they just don't want to associate themselves with Kyle. On the other hand, Rittenhouse was put through the criminal justice system and he was found not guilty by a jury of his peers. And so there's this idea that he should be allowed to rejoin society. And that can include seeking higher levels of education and trying to better himself and all these different things. So I do think he should be able to go to college somewhere. But when you're talking about some specific college that has to let him in or doesn't have to let him in, that's where it gets tricky because the colleges have every right to make their own decisions. The students who go to those schools, they have every right to make those decisions. So that's the latest on Kyle Rittenhouse, apparently becoming a college student in the fall. I have for you today one of the funniest moments from conservative media in a while. It comes to us from OAN, and they were doing this fluff piece about Donald Trump. They were calling him a great president, great patriot, and they had the sentimental music going on in the background. It's not even clear exactly why it was relevant to be doing right now as a story, but they were doing it. They were showing that they have Trump's back for the 2024 election if and when he decides to run. And right after this sentimental piece they did, they cut to a commercial break. And what commercial was it but Viagra, to make a really awkward transition that will go down in television history? Let's take a look at the clip.
We here at One America News would like to say thank you, President Trump. Your legacy as a patriot is unquestionable. You have inspired countless millions and shown our nation what it truly means to make America great again. For One America News, I'm Pearson Sharp.
Generic Viagra delivered within 48 hours in discreet packaging on approval. No one will know but you. Oh, and your mailbox. RexMD.com is the fast, easy, and affordable way to get generic Viagra.
Now that is just the best, isn't it? That is comedic gold right there, going from that sentimental news segment right to a Viagra commercial. And you have to wonder, like, did they not realize that they were going to be throwing to a Viagra commercial right away so the transition would be a little bit awkward? Did they not realize that the segment was going to be so heartfelt and sentimental? Like, what exactly went wrong there? And I feel like with OAN, you kind of have to wonder, are they all just trolling us over there? Do the right-wing commentators on that network, are they serious? Are they just playing a character? What exactly is going on? Because it just seems so out there most of the time that you have to think, like, they can't actually believe this stuff. Do they really believe this stuff? Maybe they are just trolling all of us. And in terms of transitions being awkward on television, That probably comes in first place. The one thing that would maybe rival it, though, is back at the beginning of the year when Russia had just invaded Ukraine. There was a lot of coverage of the war there on CNN. They were showing the sirens going off at one of the Ukrainian cities, followed up by a Applebee's commercial that really wasn't the best transition either. Let's take a look at that one.
And a little bit of chicken fried. Cold beer on a Friday night. A pair of jeans that fit just right.
So you'll all have to tell me which one you found more awkward, the OAN transition or the CNN transition. And to me, it's easier to laugh at the OAN one because the CNN clip had some element of tragedy to it, right, with the war going on. Whereas the OAN one, you could just take a look at that and be like, what exactly is going on at that network? So that's the latest on OAN. We don't talk about them too much anymore, but we absolutely had to cover this story. Sarah Palin, former Alaska governor and 2008 vice presidential nominee for the Republicans, she is running for Congress. As we know, she's trying to make a comeback into public life after a long hiatus, and she has now passed the first hurdle for getting the job. This is actually a special election that's going on in Alaska since Don Young died earlier this year after representing the at-large district in Alaska for 49 years. Now, Alaska has this interesting system where they have all of their candidates, regardless of party, appear on the same ballot for a first round of voting. The top four vote-getters then move on to the next round of voting, where ranked choice voting is used to determine who comes out on top. We just had the first round of voting, and we're still getting the votes in, but as of now, the results show that Palin has 29.8% of the vote, followed by another Republican named Nick Begich at 19.3%. Then we have Al Gross at 12.5% and Democrat Mary Pelota at 7.5%. So those should be the four who advance and move on to the second round. Notably, not making the cut yet still getting an impressive 4.5% of the vote was Democratic Socialist candidate Santa Claus, which I didn't realize that Santa lived up in Alaska. I thought he lived up in Canada or like maybe the international territory that makes up the North Pole. But apparently he's an Alaska resident, and who knows? Maybe he'll get him next time. Palin's near 30% in the vote is a commanding lead ahead of everyone else. But then when you note that there's something like 50 other candidates, you have to think about how the other voters are going to coalesce when the candidate number drops down to four. Also, you have ranked choice voting, so that makes it a little bit harder to predict compared to a normal election. So who knows what will happen in the second round. You just don't know who people are going to coalesce around. Maybe the other Republican will do better in the second round. Maybe the independent, Al Gross, will win. There's a good chance that maybe she's not able to pull this thing off. And that would, of course, be a major blow to Trump's endorsement record and to the state of Trumpism in this country, because not only is Palin endorsed by Trump, she in a lot of ways was Trump before Trump was Trump, notably based on how incompetent and inarticulate she was, and we didn't realize that someone so unqualified could serve in public office at such a high level. But, you know, then we got Donald Trump, and now it's somewhat normalized. Also not helping Palin and Trump is the fact that Alaska politics are a lot different than the rest of the country. They tend to be more centrist, and they like the more reasonable candidates more often than not. So who knows if she can pull it off there? It's really just not the reddest state in the country. Plus, many Alaskans view Palin as a quitter because she quit her job as governor 10 plus years back to do a reality TV show. So that just didn't sit very well with them. How do they know that she's not going to resign early from her seat in Congress? But fear not, because Palin has an excellent excuse in her back pocket in case she doesn't come out on top. She went on Mark Levin's show a few weeks ago, and she said that, you know, if I don't win, clearly it's because of voter fraud. Yeah, she's using that routine. Let's take a look at this clip from about a month ago.
Yeah, whether I have a good shot or not, there are, I think, about 50 candidates in this race. It's a real bizarre race. And
did you say 50?
Only ballot. 50. And, Mark, you'll just really appreciate this. It's mail-in only ballots. No hand counting to tabulate. Got to go through a Dominion computer to count everything. And I like yesterday, Mark, I received four ballots in the mail. I didn't even ask for any ballots. One for one of the daughters who doesn't live here. She hasn't claimed residency in Alaska since she moved outside. we call anything outside of Alaska.
Are you trying to say Murkowski?
Well, you know who wrote this bizarre election plan that we have right now going on with the ranked choice voting that's coming up and the mail-in only ballots and all that? Was Lisa Murkowski's attorney.
Unbelievable.
The devil. Mm-hmm. But you know, yeah, I mean, do I have a shot at it? Yeah, I have a shot at it. It's bizarre, though, you know, this kind of voting system. So I hope the rest of America keeps track of what's going on in Alaska so it doesn't happen to them.
Well, that's certainly the Trumpian playbook right there. If you win, everything was on the up and up, and you just got more votes from the good people of your district or your state. But if you lose, you didn't really lose. It was just rigged, and what can you do? You were a victim. So that's nice. You have that in your back pocket as an excuse, and you can really use it in any election that you want to. Of course, I want Palin to be defeated, and there's really a good chance of that happening. We'll have to see. It's going to be tight, but maybe this is a race that we can get ourselves involved in. But part of me wonders, like, if Sarah Palin does become a congressperson, would that have entertainment value? Would she have these wacky, off-the-rails speeches on the House floor that would be worth watching? I also wonder if she would interact well with people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert. Would she be too crazy for them? Would they be too crazy for her? I just don't know. So, you know, if she does end up pulling off the win in this race, that will be like the one saving grace. We get to see how she functions as a member of Congress. But hopefully it doesn't get to that. And hopefully Sarah Palin is defeated when it's time for the second round of voting. Of course, there'll be more elections to come, and we'll be following all of them. All right. Thanks very much to David for allowing me to host today's show. And if you want to check out the bonus show, make sure to become a member at joinpacman.com or go to patreon.com/DavidPacmanShow and contribute at the $5 level. I'll see you there.
Well, everybody, it's really incredible. I decide, hey, you know what? It'd be a great thing to take a break from dealing with a newborn baby and do a show. I check out what's been happening at the Trump riot hearings, and the big headline is big, massive dumps, as if that's not what I've already been dealing with at home. Incredible second day in the Trump riot hearings. Now, of course, many of you are already familiar with this entire dumps thing.
Dumps.
Yeah, you guys remember that, right?
Big, massive dumps.
Sure. Well, yesterday at the Trump riot hearings, they actually played the video. Big, massive dumps trends on Twitter after January 6th committee airs infamous Trump interview with Maria Bartiromo. Big, massive dumps have gone completely mainstream, dominating yesterday's second day of the Trump riot hearings. And my audience, of course, knows about it. This is the original. This was sort of setting the stage for explaining the different elements of Donald Trump's campaign to steal the election. For those who may not remember, this is that critical moment in American political history. Big, massive dumps.
And what happened, if you watched the election, I was called by the biggest people.
People.
Saying, congratulations, political people. Congratulations, sir, you just won the election. It was 10 o'clock and you looked at the numbers and I'm sure you felt that way.
Sure.
This election was over. And then they did dumps. They call them dumps, big, massive dumps in Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And all over.
Okay, so that is one aspect of all of the not only unproven, but debunked conspiracy theories about the election. And we're going to get into more specific claims that the January 6th committee did a really good job of saying, here's the claim, here's someone who knows saying it's bogus. And this is Republicans mostly presenting this testimony, which we will get to. But one other aspect in general of thinking about the January 6th riots is, was Trump a factor in the people that were rioting being there rioting? In other words, were they there because of something that Donald Trump said? And the January 6th committee closed yesterday's hearing with a video of exactly that, of Trump supporters saying they were there because of the things Trump said, including that there were excuse the term, massive dumps. Take a listen to this.
I know exactly what's going on right now. Fake election. They think they're going to cheat us out of our vote and put communist Biden in office. It ain't f***ing happening today, buddy.
You voted?
Yes, sir.
How'd it go?
Voted early. It went well, except for the can't really trust the software. Dominion software all over.
We voted, and right in the top right-hand corner of the Dominion voting machine that we used, there was a Wi-Fi symbol with five bars.
Uh-oh.
So that most definitely connected to the internet, without a doubt. So they stole that from us twice. We're not doing it anymore. We're not taking it anymore. So we're standing up. We're here. And whatever happens, we're not laying down again.
I'm from Pennsylvania. It didn't work.
Okay, so of an individual coughing a lot, those are all specific claims being made by Trump and people around him. So that's the sort of broader context for yesterday's hearings. Let's now get into some of the specific claims. Every central claim about the 2020 election made by failed former President Donald Trump and the people around him, including people like Mark Meadows, but also wackier people like Sidney Powell, Mike Pillow Lindell, and others. Every single one of those claims was systematically contradicted and debunked by mostly Republican testimony, as we saw during yesterday's second day of the Trump riot hearings. I'm going to give you some examples here, and you will see how comprehensively every single one of these claims is easily refuted. Former Philadelphia City Commissioner Al Schmidt, a Republican, said there is no evidence of even 8 dead people voting, never mind the 8,000 dead voters that Trump and people around him claimed.
The claim that dead people were voting. In fact, Mr. Giuliani told Pennsylvania state legislators that 8,000 dead people voted in Pennsylvania. You investigated those claims of voter fraud. Can you tell us what you found?
Not only was there not evidence of 8,000 dead voters voting in Pennsylvania, there wasn't evidence of 8. We took seriously every case that was referred to us, no matter how fantastical, no matter how absurd, and took every one of those seriously, including these.
So it's not that they say, well, you have to investigate all of it. It was investigated. You just don't like the outcome of that investigation. And dead voters, that's one bucket of claims. We've looked into it extensively. There was an investigation, I believe it was in Michigan, where they started with a list of I believe it was 10,000 supposedly dead voters. I believe it was The Guardian, if not the BBC. They said, let's randomly choose. I think it was 35 of the 1,000 or 2,000, whatever. Let's investigate them. And then with those 35, they found most of them, there was evidence that the people were alive. Like, there was just really no reason to think that they were dead. In a few cases, it was people who were indeed alive at the time that they voted. And then when they mailed in their ballot, then they died. Nothing illegal there. In some cases, there was like junior, senior confusion. I mean, it was all just picked apart. Next claim, Georgia smuggled ballots. Former acting deputy attorney general testifies that he personally investigated the Georgia smuggled ballots, found nothing, told him it was false, but it didn't matter.
To play again a testimony from Mr. Donahue, who appeared before the committee before today.
Mr. Donahue, we talked at some length about whether or not the White House or the president was informed about the Antrim report. On the result of the investigations, the interviews that had gone on Fulton County, how would those results have been communicated to the White House, to the president?
I don't know how they were initially communicated. I do know that they came up in subsequent conversations with the president, and Dad Rose and I essentially told him, we looked into that, and it's just not true.
Okay, so he was informed.
I told the president myself that several times in several conversations, that these allegations about ballots being smuggled in a suitcase and run through the machine several times, it was not true. That we looked at the video, we interviewed the witnesses, it was not true.
Right.
We're doing a class action lawsuit against all machines.
So there is another claim, the idea of ballots smuggled in, and there were videos with ominous music of suitcases in different places with no reason whatsoever to believe that the suitcases contained fraudulent ballots. People have suitcases. It's not like a huge smoking gun in and of itself. And Trump was told, and yet he continued to repeat it. And then lastly, again, just as another example, we could do this all day, but I won't do it to you. The other claim was more votes than voters in Philadelphia. Philadelphia and Pennsylvania in general became a big focus because they stopped counting and then started again. Of course, if you understand the scheduling for vote counting in Philadelphia, you would know that they just have a schedule.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
For me, when I think of Juneteenth, part of what I think about is both the both-handedness of it. That it is this moment in which we mourn the fact that freedom was kept from hundreds of thousands of enslaved people for years and for months after it had been attained by them. And then at the same time, celebrating the end of one of the most egregious things that this country has ever done.
Today, a Democracy Now! Juneteenth special, a federal holiday commemorating the day in 1865 when enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, belatedly learned of their freedom more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. We'll speak to Clint Smith, author of How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. We'll also air a speech at the United Nations by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project.
It is time for the nations that engaged in and profited from the transatlantic slave trade to do what is right and what is just. It is time for them to make reparations to the descendants of chattel slavery in the Americas. This is our global truth. The truth we as human beings understand with stark clarity. There can be no atonement if there is no repair.
And then, as Harvard University reveals the school's extensive ties to slavery, we speak with MIT historian Craig Stephen Wilder, author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Special. On this, the newly created Juneteenth federal holiday, which marks the end of slavery in the United States. The Juneteenth commemoration dates back to the last days of the Civil War, when Union soldiers landed in Galveston, Texas, on June 19, 1865, with news that the war had ended, and enslaved people belatedly learned they were freed. It was 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. In 2021, President Biden signed legislation to make Juneteenth the first new federal holiday since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day was created nearly 40 years ago. On the day after Biden signed the legislation making Juneteenth a holiday, I spoke to the writer and poet Clint Smith, author of the book How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. I began by asking him about traveling to Galveston, Texas, and his feelings on Juneteenth becoming a federal holiday.
As you mentioned, I went to Galveston, Texas. I've been writing this book for 4 years, and I went 2 years ago, and it was marking the 40th anniversary of when Texas had made Juneteenth a state holiday, and it was the Al Edwards prayer breakfast. The late Al Edwards Sr. is the state legislator, a black state legislator, who made possible and advocated for the legislation that turned Juneteenth into a holiday, a state holiday in Texas. And so I went in part because I wanted to spend time with people who were the actual descendants of those who had been freed by General Gordon Granger's General Order Number 3. And it was a really remarkable moment because I was in this place, on this island, on this land, with people for whom Juneteenth was not an abstraction. It was not a performance. It was not merely a symbol. It was part of their tradition. It was part of their lineage. It was an heirloom that had been passed down that had made their lives possible. And so I think I gained a more intimate sense of what that holiday meant, and to sort of broaden